Welcome to our special broadcast on the Michigan Public Radio Network. I'm Rick Pluta. I'm the Lansing Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio. This is an election year edition of Michigan Calling. Last week we had Senator Debbie Stabenow. Today we welcome the Republican challenger, former Congressman Pete Hoekstra. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's good to be with you. Good morning.
Okay, we're going to spend this hour talking to Congressman Hoekstra about issues that matter to Michigan voters. Marquette, Grand Rapids, Detroit, Bay City, we want to hear from you. The phone number to call is 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762. Message us on Facebook or Twitter at Michigan Calling or email us at michigancalling@gmail.com. It's probably no surprise, Congressman, that our first question is about jobs.
My name is Amy McLennan, and I'm from Farmington Hills, Michigan. I would like to know what the candidates, their plan of action is regarding unemployment.
Congressman?
Well, I think clearly this is the issue that I hear most about as I go across the state. Michigan, you know, for 4 years, the last 4 years of the Granholm administration, we had the highest unemployment rate in the country. Michigan is starting to turn around. We're seeing some improvement, but we still have persistently high unemployment. So I'm not surprised it's the first question. It should be the first question. What can we do at a federal level? Michigan is a state that is based on manufacturing. We're based on agriculture. We've got, you know, obviously we've got higher ed and tourism. But there's one thing that is a critical component of driving Michigan's economy and making us more competitive, not only here in the United States, but on a global basis. That is driving affordable energy, energy independence. You know, I'm for more exploration of American energy. I am for more using the new technology to exploit our natural gas capacity and our reserves. I am for using clean coal and nuclear and for developing clean energy alternatives. We get low-cost, affordable American energy. It is going to be a boom to the American economy. We keep $400 billion of U.S. currency in America rather than sending it overseas. We also will fuel manufacturing and agriculture because energy is a huge component of both of those industries.
Under what you're proposing, how long would it take to bring down energy costs, and how long would it take for that to have an effect on the economy? Both questions, please.
Sure. I mean, you've already seen it with natural gas. Natural gas prices have come down from about a high of $13 for a million cubic feet of gas down to roughly $3.50, $3. Now, that's already, you know, providing a tremendous boom to Michigan's economy in terms of manufacturing and agricultural. Natural gas is the feedstock for fertilizer. It's a feedstock for plastics. It's, you know, the key component for use in foundries and those kinds of things where you're melting steel. And so, you know.
So how long?
Well, for natural gas, it took about 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. All right. I think for oil and the full use, what I think you can see a definite improvement probably within the next 2 to 3 years. But what you want to have is you want to have long-term stable prices for energy. And if we get America energy independent, that is what we will see. Then you can see businesses planning their investments and those types of things and deciding that Michigan and America is the best place for them to invest and grow manufacturing and grow agriculture.
Explain to people, there's been a lot of talk about using government tax incentives and things like that to encourage industries and job creation. Explain to people your thoughts on what role the government plays in job creation.
Well, what the government should be doing is it should be creating a broad playing field where America and Michigan are competitive on a global basis. Good energy policy, good tax policy, good labor policy, good education policy to make sure that we've got the skilled workers to drive and provide the workers that we need for a growing high-tech, manufacturing, agriculture, a very diverse economy. When the federal government or the state government gets into blessing one particular company or one particular technology, what we find is that we start wasting money. We've seen that with A123. We've seen that with LG Chem. You know, almost $400 million of government tax, you know, our tax money being wasted because the government picked certain companies and certain technologies at the expense of others.
And what your opponent says, though, is that and others, that although there will be some bad bets when the government does this, that if we don't do this, then we're going to lose those industries and the jobs that are associated with those industries to Japan, to Korea, to Germany.
That's totally wrong. Okay? I mean, you know, LG Chem, A123, those were bad investments by bureaucrats out of the Energy Department. They were bad decisions by the Obama administration. You know, create a level playing. No one is smart enough, and I'm sorry, I'm not smart enough, but either is Senator Stabenow to pick the winning technologies for the next decade and the winning companies, and that's not the role of government. And we've seen what her strategies and her policies have resulted in. And you're exactly right. She has said, to get this economy going, we need another stimulus plan. She has said, you know, we ought to double down on batteries, probably double down on Solyndra. I'm not ready to make those decisions. I'm for creating a level playing field. And for all these bright, smart people that we have in the state of Michigan that maybe don't know how to write a federal grant, but they do know how to invent, create an opportunity for them to start and grow a business. Let's not give money to the people who just know how to leverage the power, the network in Washington and how to write a federal grant so they get money at the expense of someone else.
But when we talk about trade policy and economic policy, you know, one of the complaints is that we have foreign competitors that do subsidize their industries, that government intervenes and lowers their cost. And that's the argument, that if we don't match them, then we're going to lose to them.
Then what we do is we hold them accountable for trade agreements, for government involvement, government subsidization through the World Trade Organization. We file the complaints against these companies, against these countries for unfair trade advantages. We then put in the tariffs that recognize these unfair government advantages. Just because other countries are stupid and think that they can drive the market, we shouldn't embrace those kinds of policies. That's not who America is. If Senator Stabenow and the Energy Department or some other department had been around, you know, 20, 25 years ago, I doubt that Apple Computer would have ever qualified for a federal grant. You know, you've got all of these other companies that have now are household names. Microsoft, they probably would, Hewlett Packard, they would never have qualified. We wouldn't have been smart enough to pick them out. Create a level playing field. We will be amazed what we will see with American technology, American ingenuity, and American creativity. That's what always has happened in America. Let's not change that model.
Okay, we're going to go now to our next question.
My name's Ann Rawl, and I'm from Detroit. I want to know from the mainstream candidates why it is that the Democrats and the Republicans never talk about poverty anymore.
Oh, I think we talk a tremendous amount about poverty because what we're always doing is we're trying to talk about how we're going to lift and provide opportunity for everyone to improve the quality of their life, how we're going to provide opportunity, whether it is about education. I've spent a tremendous amount of time talking about education, reforming education. Because education from my perspective is the key to ensuring that people can find a way out of poverty. A strong economy, growing jobs, getting the unemployment rate down from 8% down to 4.5% gets people out of poverty, providing economic opportunity in Detroit by investing in infrastructure, whether it's a new bridge, whether it's a new rail tunnel, whether it is a deep water port, whether it's expanding the airport into an air metropolis. All of these types of things would be a boom to all of Michigan, but especially providing an opportunity for people to get out of poverty.
I want to just bring it back to education, because you said that you're not a fan of No Child Left Behind, which is a Bush-era education reform, mm-hmm. or Race to the Top, which is an Obama administration-proposed education reform. Why are you opposed to those?
Because I think the real drivers for quality education are parents, local communities, local schools, and the state. Why should we have the federal government, bureaucrats out of Washington, dictating policy all across the state of Michigan? They've never been here. They don't know the challenges of Muskegon versus Marquette versus Holland versus Grand Rapids versus Flint versus Detroit. Get them out of our schools. Just about everybody will admit that what No Child Left Behind has done, it has driven bureaucracy and not driven improvements in education.
What is your view on what the government should do in terms of a social safety net?
Well, government clearly has a responsibility to provide a social safety net. The first caller, the second caller talking about poverty.
What should it look like?
Well, I mean, I think it has to, what have we done? We've provided to make sure that people have and get the basic requirements for health care, the basic requirements for nutrition, the basic opportunity to have a roof over their heads and those types of things. So we provide a social safety net that meets those kinds of requirements that, we provide for the minimum benefits that they need to survive and to be effective and to be safe and secure in America.
Is the social safety net adequate right now?
Oh, I think I'm sure you're always going to find exceptions. You'll find certain places where there may be gaps. You'll find certain places where people think that, the social safety net has come up too high. I mean, in the last 3-4 years, I think we've increased the number of people on food stamps by 17 million people, from around 31 million to over 47, 48 million people. I think some people are now arguing that, hey, what's happened here? Obviously, they're believing that, food stamps now apply to certain people that should never have gotten them or should not be getting them.
Okay, and we can pick that up in a few minutes. Thank you, Congressman Hoekstra. And in just a moment, we're going to take a very short break for our local station identification. And you are listening to Michigan Calling, an hour with Pete Hoekstra on the Michigan Public Radio Network. Welcome back. I'm Rick Pluta with Congressman Pete Hoekstra, taking your calls and questions. Pete Hoekstra, the Republican nominee for Michigan's U.S. Senate seat. The number to call and ask a question is 866-255-2762, 866-255-2762. You can also send a message on Facebook or Twitter at Michigan Calling or email us at michigancalling@gmail.com. Foreign policy, a big part of the Senate's purview. Congressman, you have experience in this area as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and it is also the topic of our first question going into this segment.
Hi, my name is Zach Hendrickson. I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I would like to ask if either of you would support military intervention in Syria or a possible invasion of Iran.
Congressman?
The problem with both of these, number one, military intervention, I'm not sure is going to solve the problem in Syria, and I'm not sure it would solve the problem in Iran. For about 30 years, we had a bipartisan policy in the Middle East. It was implemented by Bill Clinton. It was carried out by Bill Clinton, George Bush, the Bush before that, and Reagan. And the policy was very straightforward. Number one, we were going to have a strong relationship with Israel. We were going to make sure that Iran did not get a nuclear weapon. We were going to build the number of allies that we had in the Middle East. We wanted stability, and then more recently, we wanted allies that would help tap down radical jihadism. President Obama threw that strategy out the window and said, what we're going to do is we're going to push for democratic reforms. We embraced the people on the streets in Cairo, did the same thing in Libya. We now no longer have stability in the Middle East. We've got a resurgent al-Qaeda. We have Iran that's 4 years closer to a nuclear weapon, and Israel's worried about whether we've got their back or not. So we're now in a deep hole. I'm very concerned about Syria. I wouldn't send troops in. I think what you're going to see in Syria, once the Assad regime is gone, and it's going to go, I just don't know when, but you're going to see a Syria that looks very much like Libya. It's going to be balkanized. I think there are more effective ways with trade sanctions and other mechanisms to ensure that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. We should pursue those. I would be very, very hesitant to have troops go into – I can't imagine that we would have U.S. boots on the ground in Iran.
So do you think that era is just done?
What
era? Of sending troops into these hot spots?
Well, I mean, hot spots. Do I see in Iran the type of intervention that we saw in Iraq? The answer is no. Are there other ways that you can have an imprint on Iran that has a whole lot less boots on the ground or no boots on the ground? Yes, I think that is possible. But I think it's very, very unlikely that you will see the kind of intervention that we had in Iraq happen anytime soon.
I'd like to ask you about partisanship and foreign policy, because you just talked about how, you know, a multitude of presidents have executed our tradition of foreign policy. The Senate has purview over working with the president on foreign policy. You were chair of the House Intelligence Committee. And I'm thinking back to the Clinton era in 1998, when the institution of the presidency and the institution of Congress were consumed with the presidential impeachment at the very moment when al-Qaeda was plotting the murder of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil. Was the 105th Congress that you were a member of, was it somehow culpable in getting the eye off the ball as all of this was going on?
Absolutely not.
I mean,
the American government is big enough to do more than one thing at a time. Clearly, there are people in the Senate, and you're absolutely right. The Senate has a clear and a bigger role in holding the president accountable and working with the administration on foreign policy. But you've got foreign policy, you've got taxes, you've got the economy, you've got a whole range of issues. And to say because we were moving in one direction that maybe people didn't agree with, because you were doing that, you're now culpable. No, that's an outrageous argument. The federal government needs to be better. And, you know, I know what happened in the late 90s. I know the opportunities, and I know that Bill Clinton, and I know what President Clinton, he was focused on al-Qaeda, and he was well aware of the threat from al-Qaeda. Congress knew it, the administration knew it, and, you know, someday there will be a book written about the lead-up to 9/11 and the decisions that were made in the late 90s and how that either led or facilitated or hindered what happened on 9/11/2001. But to say that the House was working on something else and so that distracted, no, that's a bogus argument. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yep. You brought up the budget, and let's stop and talk about that for a few minutes, starting once again with Medicare, and we have Janet on the line. Janet? Janet, are you with us? All right. We seem to have lost Janet. Her question, as I understand it, was on Medicare, which has been central to really a lot of the discussions in this campaign. You were a supporter of the first Ryan budget proposal, which I know is not the one on the table right now. Were you not?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I have been. I was on a budget committee, and you know, if the answer is about how are we going to fix this deficit, mm-hmm. I was there. In the 90s, when we had a plan to fix the deficit. And what was the plan? Reform entitlements, slow the growth of spending, and cut taxes. It's not going to be a whole lot different in 2013 when I begin serving in the U.S. Senate. We are going to have to reform entitlements, and we will reform them for people who are older than 55, for future generations, so that Medicare and Social Security will be there. I think we reform the tax code. I don't think we cut taxes, but we reform the tax code to encourage entrepreneurship and economic growth. And then the third thing is I think we're going to have to cut spending rather than restrain the growth of spending. We do those three things, we can get this economy going, and we can get ourselves back on the path to a balanced budget. And you know, people say, well, it's the Ryan plan. You know, people need to understand what a budget does is it lays out a framework. Paul laid out a framework for reforming Medicare. We did that, the same thing John Kasich did that in 95 and 96 in terms of reforming welfare. And you remember what happened. It went to, you know, it went through the House, it went through the Senate, it went to Bill Clinton a first time. He vetoed it. It went to him a second time. He vetoed it. It went to him a third time, and he signed it. Each time, the bill evolved, and we finally ended up with exactly what you need on entitlement reform. Broad bipartisan consensus on reforming welfare, saving the welfare program, but making it affordable and making sure that we provided that safety net. You're going to have to do the same thing on Medicare and Social Security. You start, Paul Ryan starts at a certain point. It has evolved somewhat. The Democrats are going to start at a different point. But you go through the negotiations and hopefully you end up with a reform plan for both of these programs that have bipartisan support and that put us on a long-term trajectory of sustainability for both Medicare and for Social Security. That is what we need to do. That's what I did in the 1990s.
Okay, and I think Eileen from Royal Oak has a follow-up for you on that, and Congressman. Eileen?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering about Medicare also. I was wondering, Mr. Hoekstra, if you are in favor of the voucher program. In other words, you know, any premium support or to buy insurance from healthcare companies instead of having the Medicare that we have now.
Okay, Eileen, thanks for the question.
Yeah, thanks, Eileen. I mean, you know, part of the Ryan proposals that says for younger people, future generations, as they start approaching Medicare and Medicare retirement age, and they can take advantage of Medicare, that what they will have is they will have a range of options. They can choose traditional Medicare, just like I'll be eligible for when I get to Medicare age, or they may have some options from the private sector, and that those private sector options then will be provided. They'll receive a premium support package. And, yeah, I think opening up traditional Medicare and allowing individuals to have choices and to enhance the system. Remember, Eileen, what we need to be talking about here is we need to be talking about what reforms do we put in place to make sure that our kids and our grandkids will have the benefit of Medicare, just like my parents and what I hope to have in Medicare. It is about saving the future of Medicare and making sure that we keep the promise of quality health care for seniors.
Okay. Eileen, thanks a lot for the question. Congressman, you just spoke a moment about tax reform. You don't want an overall tax cut, but you do want to reform, reshape the tax structure that we have. So what that means is that some people would get a tax cut and some people would probably get a tax increase. Where who would get what under what you have in mind?
Well, I think, you know, the framework, sure, I mean, but I think what we're talking about here is making sure that the overall distribution of taxes among, you know, the wealthy and the middle class, that proportion doesn't change. Now, individuals within those different groups may change, but we're not talking about a shift of saying we're going to put more burden on the wealthy or we're going to move some of the tax burden to the middle class. We're talking about simplifying the tax code, keeping the distribution of tax responsibility and tax accountability basically the same as what we have, but taking what is perhaps one of the worst tax systems for individual taxes, personal taxes, and for corporate taxes, simplifying it so that we get a tax structure that is more competitive, again, that will encourage economic growth. What we want is a tax code that will encourage and spur job creation so we can get America back to work. That is what we need to be looking at.
Do you believe that higher income people should pay a bigger share, a bigger percentage of their income in taxes than lower income people?
Sure, they do it right now.
They do. And, yeah. and you agree.
And we're not talking about changing the tax burden or the check, you know, the proportion that wealthy pay versus what lower income.
But also as a matter of principle, you agree with that.
Okay. With that. Yeah.
This is a Facebook question from Jason from Lapeer, who says, I would like to ask Senator Hoekstra what his thoughts on the Obama administration's health care reform are, and if he is opposed to it, what alternative solutions he might suggest.
Well, what I do is I used to wake up and believe that we have the best health care excuse me. We have the best healthcare system in the world. It has its flaws.
What I'm afraid of, what happens with Obamacare, is that we are going to take the best health care system in the world and we're going to change it into something that nobody can explain to me exactly how it works. All right? So that is the problem that we have. I know that for rural America, rural Michigan, it's going to be devastating. You're going to see consolidation of hospitals, consolidation of medical providers, and you're going to have to, you know, in the UP, you're going to see lots of hospital closures. Northern Michigan, you're going to see the same type of thing. I also think you're going to see a decrease in quality of health care and the quantity of health care that's going to be available to the people of America and the people of Michigan. I would go back to the system we had before Obamacare. Remember, Obamacare also took $716 billion out of Medicare.
But reinvested it in the health care system.
Well, put it back in the health care system. But I've got a senator out there that's saying, you know, in her ad saying, you know, if anybody tries to take a dollar out of Medicare, they're going to have to go through me. Well, it looks like she's already run over herself because she voted for something that took $716 billion out of Medicare. But the question then is, you go back to the system, and I think we have the best system in the world. It clearly has flaws. Let's write targeted bills that deal with people with pre-existing conditions who can't get insurance. Let's deal with affordability. Let's deal with accessibility. Let's deal with tort reform. But let's put them into targeted bills to fix the problems that we had in health care. Don't take the whole health care system out and replace it with something that no one in this administration, that this senator cannot explain how it will work or what the consequences will be to health care in Michigan as a result of Obamacare being put into place. It has to be repealed, and we go back to a functioning good system, and we fix the problems in it.
So tell people, we can't cover all of that. We just don't have enough time. But just to pick one, what would you do? Briefly, what would you do about dealing with people with pre-existing conditions?
I'd allow, and we would work with the states and put in place a high-risk pool. Okay, you do it with insurance.
Would it be a government-sponsored high-risk pool?
It maybe subsidized either by, you know, the premiums that we all pay for health insurance. So it may be subsidized by the health insurance industry. There may be some government money that goes into it. But create a high-risk pool to make sure that these individuals can go in and buy affordable insurance. And at the same time, for their extra costs, that there is a way to cover those medical expenses for people with, you know, these pre-existing conditions, which may indicate to, you know, actuaries or whatever, that these individuals are going to be heavy users of the healthcare system. We need to get them in the system. We need to make sure that they can get insurance in an affordable way. It is what a compassionate America does.
But since we do have that system known as Obamacare, you know, looming right now, was it a mistake or not a mistake for Michigan to refrain from creating its own state healthcare exchange?
Well, I think this is one of the things that the governor and I talk about a lot. And, you know, the governor and I have clearly talked about, you know, one of the problems you've got in government today is you've got the federal government meddling in areas where the state should have responsibility. We talked about that. That is K-12 education, transportation, a whole series of things where the federal government should diminish its role and leave the responsibility to the states. As to what the tactical decision that the Michigan legislature made about whether and when they were going to do the health care exchanges, that's an issue for the state legislature. You know, when I'm the U.S. senator, I'm going to focus on the things that the federal government ought to be focused on and working on, and I'm going to allow the state to take the lead in the places where it needs to work.
But that's a place where the legislature does look for guidance from its congressional delegation on you know, what they should do.
No, I don't. I mean, they would have gotten mixed reactions because it was a political decision. Do we do the exchanges now, or do we wait until after the November 6th election to see what the consequences may be and see whether, you know, we are going to have Obamacare or whether it's going to be dramatically reformed? So it was a political decision in the state legislature. If someone had asked me for an opinion, I might have expressed an opinion. It would have been a political opinion. It would not have been about, you know, the cost that the state would have incurred and all of those kinds of things. We got lots of smart people here at the state level. We've got a smart governor. We've got good legislators. You know, they're equipped to work that out. We got trillion-dollar deficits, 8% national unemployment, $16 trillion debt. There's a lot for me to be working on as your new, as your next U.S. senator, other than trying to meddle in the affairs of the state.
Okay. Before we go to the break, a quick question. A lot of people have asked about this. Would you take a term limits pledge as a U.S. senator?
Yeah, I'll take the term limits pledge that says the term limits pledge is as long as the voters of Michigan want to elect me and send me back to Washington, I'll go. But, you know, I'm at a point in life now where, you know, I have a very, very hard time believing that at 75, you know, which is a number of years away, but that I'm still going to be on Capitol Hill trudging from the Senate office buildings over to the U.S. Capitol. I really see going in right now as an opportunity to serve, address these problems of the deficit, the economy, the debt, health care, on some of the national or some of the foreign policy issues. And if we get us going in the right direction, I don't need to be there for a very long time.
So you're saying you're biologically term limited?
Everybody's biologically term limited, and so, yeah.
Should the Senate end the filibuster rule?
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, what you need to hear, the filibuster is, you know, passing legislation has always been designed as being hard. I found that out when I passed the Intelligence Reform Bill. We went through months and months of negotiations. We got it done. Debbie Stabenow is finding that out with the Farm Bill. She's gone through a bunch of negotiations. She can't get it done.
And that is Congressman Pete Hoekstra, the Republican candidate for Senate. We have a short break here. You're listening to Michigan Calling, an hour with Pete Hoekstra on the Michigan Public Radio Network. And welcome back to Michigan Calling. Rick Pluta here with Congressman Pete Hoekstra, the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate. The phone number is 866-255-2762. You can message us on Facebook or Twitter at Michigan Calling or email us at michigancalling@gmail.com. And we are going to go right to the phones here. And we have an energy and Great Lakes question from Caitlin. Caitlin, are you with us?
Yeah, I am.
All right. Thanks for waiting. Your question.
My question is, do you support repealing the ban on drilling for oil underneath our Great Lakes?
The number one, I don't believe we should ever be in a position where we've got drilling rigs or anything in Lake Michigan or any of the Great Lakes. I think that is that's something that I don't want. In terms of taking a look at whether we drill under the Great Lakes, you know, I think that is something that continues to be driven by technology. Technology has taken huge advances in the last number of years. That's why natural gas prices have dropped significantly. If we got to a point where we had a high degree of confidence that, you know, drilling down, you know, 10,000 feet and drilling over and being under the Great Lakes, that were that was, you know, a safe technology, and that, you know, that reasonable people on all sides of this issue would take a look at it and saying it's safe, you know, we might take a look at it. Is it a number one priority for me going to Washington and saying repeal that or change it? Absolutely not. I am all about, you know, taking the opportunities that we have for energy under the current guidelines that are in place that will enable us to be energy independent, but changing the current framework of that I don't think is necessary and isn't anything that I would spend time on.
Do you think it's safe?
Well, I'm not the expert, and I've not looked at it at this point. Right now, you know, over the last number of years, we've had that ban in place. And so, like I said, I'm not advocating for changing it. I'm not – but as technology moves forward, and if – the Great Lakes are our most – one of our most precious assets. And if we do anything to change the way that we interact and we protect the Great Lakes – I think the key operative word here is we have to have broad bipartisan consensus for all the people that are looking at this issue before we change anything. I mean, I think this is one of the things where we have had unanimity and we've had bipartisan support in Washington at the state level, at the state compact level. We are all working together to protect the Great Lakes. We maybe disagree around the edges, but the core of protecting the Great Lakes, there's no discussion, no debate about that. And I don't want to change that bipartisan, effective working relationship. So, you know, like I said, it's no priority. It's no issue on my part to change that. It really right now makes no difference.
Okay, Caitlin, thanks a lot for your question. And we're going to stick with energy policy with Mike from Grand Rapids. Mike, your question for Congressman Hoekstra.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time this morning. When you talk about picking winners and losers in energy, why do you ignore the massive government subsidies to oil and gas companies that dwarf any investments in renewable energy? And when you talk about expanding energy production, what are you going to do to help reduce energy consumption?
Okay. Start with the government oil and gas subsidies.
Well, a lot of what happens with the oil and gas subsidies are subsidies that are available to people in the industry, whether in manufacturing or that. But like I said, I'm for creating a level playing field all across the board for green energy, for oil, for gas, for coal, and all of those types of things. Create a much, you know, create a level playing field and allow these things to compete for themselves. I mean, I think the strategy on that and my position on that is pretty clear.
Okay. Very quickly, I'd like to ask you about, you've made an issue of your opponent missing a tax payment on her home in Washington.
I've not made an issue of that.
Don't you have ads on the air that deal with that?
No.
Does failing to pay taxes disqualify someone from holding office?
The number one, I don't have ads on that. Okay. There are ads running on that. They are not my ads.
Mistake.
Okay. Yeah. But. I mean, I think what you take a look at is I think with this organization, I don't know what their motivation is or whatever. I don't think failure to pay taxes, obviously doesn't disqualify people in this administration. We've got a Secretary of Treasury who didn't pay taxes. It's kind of like, you've got people in Washington who are arguing for paying, increasing people's taxes on a regular basis. And then it's kind of interesting that you find out that they haven't been paying their taxes on time over a period of years. I think they're just raising an issue and, that's their business.
Okay. But you don't think that would disqualify someone from holding
the minimum qualifications for serving in the U.S. Senate are outlined in this little thing called the Constitution. And, the voters will determine what qualifies or disqualifies someone for serving in that office. There are probably people out there who are very, very frustrated, who are having trouble making ends meet, and they're having trouble paying their taxes, and they're just very, very surprised that they've got a U.S. senator who maybe hasn't paid their taxes.
Well, speaking of the Constitution, I'd like to ask you about what you've said about repealing the 17th Amendment and direct public election of U.S. senators. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, let me tell you, number one, how this comes out. I am more than willing to engage the voters of Michigan, and I participate in town hall meetings all the time. When someone takes the time and the thoughtfulness of asking a question, and someone asked me a question about the 17th Amendment, I'm a poli-sci major. I've been in government for a while. What I did is I explained to them the change in the nature of how Congress worked when the 17th Amendment was added to the Constitution, the direct election of senators. Instead of having them named by the legislature. What you found is that there was really no advocate anymore for states' rights. All right, that's the political analysis. Take a look at my record. In 18 years in the House, I've never sponsored a piece of legislation or co-sponsored anything to do with the 17th Amendment. It's never been on my agenda. But what I did is I took the time and the courtesy to answer a question from someone who had thought about this. And that's the fundamental difference between me and Debbie. I am willing to engage the voters and answer the questions that they're asking. She's unwilling to. She's unwilling to engage in debates. She's saying no to the people of Michigan on debates. And so,
did you make a tactical mistake, you or your team, in not accepting the two dates for debates when that was offered?
No, I mean, Debbie never wanted to debate. Debbie would have always, Senator Stabenow would have always found a reason not to debate. You know, so she did not want to debate. She has, you know, she's got a, they've got a terrible track record in terms of what's happened in Washington over the last 4 to 6 years. They don't have a vision for the future. She saw what happened to the president when the president got involved in a debate. She was never going to debate. She had made that that decision early on. And so, you know, I don't think there's anything that we could have done. For the last two and a half weeks, we've been telling people, both the Detroit Econ Club, we've been telling the Grand Valley. Yesterday I was on with Frank Beckman in Southeast Michigan and offered to Frank. I said, hey, Frank, why don't you have Debbie and I on your program? No, you tell me the morning, the time, the day, I will be there. He said, that's a good idea. We'll see if she comes. My bet is she won't show up for that either.
Okay, and we have David in Farmington Hills, who's been waiting for a very long time to ask a question. David?
Hi, can you hear me?
We can, David. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Yeah, back in the 1970s, a Chinese-American named Vincent Chin was beaten to death by two people with baseball bats who'd been told by politicians that their jobs were being shipped to Asia. We fast forward to the current campaign, and you had the temerity to put out an ad on a website featuring the most vile and racist anti-Asian stereotypes I'd seen in my lifetime in the Debbie Spend It Now campaign.
David, can we keep it civil?
I'm being very civil. I wonder how it is that you feel that you can represent all of the people of Michigan when you've made your feelings for Asian Americans so transparently clear through the messaging that you've presented on your own website and through that advertisement.
David, Congressman, a chance to respond.
Well, I mean, I obviously we're not going to get David's vote. The bottom line on that, the you know, Debbie Stabenow has made China a major issue in this campaign, as have the presidential candidates. Clearly, when we are spending trillions of dollars more in our budgets each and every year, building up this debt of what China holds, a significant portion of it, we are jeopardizing America's future by not being competitive and not doing the things that we need to do to make America strong.
Was that ad a misstep?
We were not prepared to respond to the type of comments, the outrageous comments that David just made. Our opponents effectively moved the messaging to make it an issue about race, which it was not about. It was all about American spending. It was all about accumulating debt and what we were doing to future generations.
Okay. While we're on the topics of campaigns, that Senate candidates, Republican candidates in other states have gotten into trouble for things that they've said, particularly about abortion. Are what we're hearing about going on in other states from those candidates, are those affecting you? Are you seeing some ripple effect?
Not to date, no.
Okay. So all these are just individual races.
I mean, people know my position on life. I'm a pro-life candidate. But I also believe that we need to be talking about a lot of the things that we agree on, both pro-life and folks on the other side, is that we want to minimize unwanted pregnancies, and we want to provide alternatives like abortion, like adoption and those types of things.
Do you favor exceptions?
My exception is for the life of the mother.
Okay. Why don't we go to Vanessa from Howell, who's been wanting to talk about some women's issues. Vanessa, thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you. My question is, protecting women and vulnerable persons against violence is important, and I'd like to know what your stance on the current Violence Against Women Act is.
Okay, Vanessa, thanks for the question.
There have been different versions of that bill in the House and the Senate. I don't remember exactly what the exact differences are. I think it's passed. I'm not positive. I believe there's been a version that has passed the House that I could have supported.
Why?
Like I said, I don't have all the specifics on this bill in front of me. Okay.
No, fair enough.
And where the arguments were and those types of things. But
I'm just asking, what are the broad parameters that you'd be looking for in a bill that you could support?
Well, I mean, I think what you need to do is you need to take a look, make sure it's enforceable, make sure that it is reasonable, and it's addressing the problems that are out there.
Okay. Fair enough. I'd like to stop and go back to China policy. Does Mitt Romney have it right on calling out China on currency manipulation, imposing sanctions, going to the World Trade Organization?
Oh, I think that holding China accountable, absolutely. I mean, I served
everyone
on
everyone wants to hold China accountable. It's a question of how you go about it.
Well, you have to go to the World Trade Organization. That is the mechanism that is in there. I mean, I voted against permanent normal trade relations with China because I believe that basically China cheats. They cheat by manipulating their currency. They cheat by stealing intellectual property rights. They cheat with a number of the laws that they have in place in terms of the requirements that they put on our businesses to sell into China that we don't put on Chinese businesses to sell into America. And I think leveling the playing field with China is absolutely essential if we are going to bring this economy back. We cannot put American workers at a disadvantage. We need a fair trade relationship with China. We need to hold them accountable to the standards that they agree to.
Would this be the moment to turn up the heat that in a couple of weeks China is going to go through a transition of leadership, a transition that, as a practical matter, will still be underway come January?
I mean, the bottom line is foreign policy is long term. It is very, very difficult. It should be bipartisan. You're not going to turn up you're not going to turn the heat up on China over a couple of weeks and say, wow, that's going to have an impact. You have to keep the pressure on China over a long period of time to change their behavior. You know, fits and starts on foreign policy just don't work.
Okay. And let's go to now a question. Someone would like to ask you about the gridlock in Washington.
Hi, my name is Dan Burns. I'm from Ann Arbor. I'm a prof at the U of M. And my question to either of you, Senator and candidate, is are you prepared to do something drastic to break gridlock in the Senate? In particular, are you willing to reconsider the necessity for 60 votes to pass something? Thank you.
Okay, and thank you. Now you said that you support keeping the filibuster rule, but is there something else that you would do to try and break the impasses?
Well, I mean, what you have to do is you have to be professional, all right? I mean, I think it was last week on this program that the senator said, how do you fix bipartisanship? And her response was fewer Republicans and more Democrats. Well, hey, that's a great way to start the discussion. I take a look at my record in the U.S. House. We worked with Bill Clinton in the 1990s to get America moving into an era of prosperity and balanced budgets, Republicans in the House and a Democrat in the White House. I investigated the Teamsters. I had a corrupt leader of the Teamsters removed from office, but I did it in such a way that when the process was done, I had a personal relationship with Jim Hoffa, who I don't agree with on much politically. And I also had great respect from rank-and-file union members for the way that we professionally went about it. I was given the task of reforming the intelligence community.
You also played a role in ending federal oversight of the Teamsters.
And actually, the federal oversight is still there. You still have the
reducing it.
Well, no, it's I tried to reduce it, but it's still there. You've got this oversight board, which has now been in place for more than 20 years, which I think does need to be gone, but it's still there. And then I come out of the business world where you have to focus on results. I was given the assignment of leading the effort to reform the intelligence community after 9/11. Worked with Joe Lieberman, worked with Jane Harmon, and with Susan Collins. And we met just about every day for three and a half months. We ground it out. We passed reform with huge bipartisan majorities. That's how you get things done. You're serious about it. You build the competence and the expertise in these areas, and then you build the personal relationships. It's not about process. It's about personal competence and getting things done. And that's what I learned when I spent 15 years working at Herman Miller. And that's exactly what I did when I was in the U.S. House of Representatives. And I was privileged to have the opportunity to lead on some very, very difficult issues. And I brought Democrats and Republicans together to get things done. And that's what I would bring to the U.S. Senate.
Does that same observation apply to the House Republican leadership in Washington?
Oh, I think so. Right. I mean, what observation?
That they're failing in terms of being professional and personal and building personal relationships.
Well, I think the whole system today in D.C. has broken down. I'm telling people what my record is and the approach that I would take and the ability that I've had to be successful, which is a sharp contrast to where this senator is. She can't pass a farm bill.
She can't investigate John Corzine. She works on a budget committee that hasn't passed a budget in more than 3 years. You know, that's outrageous performance and demonstrates an inability to work with people across the aisle to get things done.
Okay, and that is going to have to be the final word on the question that Congressman Pete Hoekstra, the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate. Congressman, thank you for taking
great to
the
be
time
with
to
you.
Be with
great,
us.
Great. Thanks for the questions from your listeners. Enjoyed being with you today.
And our thanks, too, to all of you who shared a question, whether it was by phone, email, by talking to one of our reporters. Michigan Calling was produced and directed by the exceptional Zoe Clark, engineered by the legendary Bob Scon. We had help from Jake Neer, Peg Watson, and Melissa Benmark. Thank you to Michigan Radio for hosting us for these programs. This has been a special broadcast on the Michigan Public Radio Network.